Rather than refute skeptics, the Pentagon's leaders followed Cheney's example and simply decided that the time for debate was past. Such an assertion might not affect civilians outside the government, but inside the military establishment, it could be issued with the force of an order. The Joint Staff effectively stated that view in the form of a strategic guidance for combatant commanders. In mid-October, a draft of this guidance was sent out to planning officers on the staffs of the senior U.S. military commanders around the world, often called the SINCs. The message was simple. We are preparing to order that a war with Iraq be considered part of the war on terror. That was an unusual order, and smacked of a politicized military leadership. It provoked a series of swift responses, some of them quite blunt. How the hell did a war on Iraq become part of the war on terrorism? Was how one officer on the Joint Staff summarized the reaction of four of those commanders' staffers. The draft didn't seem consistent with a Pentagon directive exactly a year earlier that had laid out five clear lines of attack in a global counteroffensive against terrorism, all focused on hitting terrorist groups with global reach and their state sponsors. There is no link between Saddam Hussein and 9/11, one of the responses argued. Don't mix the two. This is going to work hell with the Allies. What is going on? One of the officers who was caught in the middle of this went to Army Lieutenant General George Casey, then the J-5, the Chief of Strategic Plans and Policy on the staff of the Joint Chiefs, and reported these puzzled, angry comments from the field. Casey, who in 2004 was to become the top U.S. officer in Iraq, laid down the law. The discussion was over. Look, this is part of the war on terror. This officer remembered Casey instructing him. Iraq is one of those state supporters, and it is a state that has used weapons of mass destruction. That was the message that went out to the SINCs staffs near the end of 2002, in the form of a highly classified five-paragraph order. In a bureaucratic maneuver, in order to keep Feith from trying to edit it word by word and comma by comma, an excruciating process that the Joint Staff had come to dread, it was sent out as a change to an existing strategic guidance rather than as a new statement. Its third paragraph said that should it become necessary to conduct combat operations against Iraq, this activity was to be thought of as part of the wider war against terrorism. As that message was being finalized, Lieutenant General Newbold quietly retired from his job on the Joint Staff and left the military. It had been common knowledge on the staff that he opposed the invasion of Iraq, but he managed to keep that from leaking out. His is the only known departure from the senior ranks of the military over the looming Iraq war. Publicly, Newbold was discreet, saying he was leaving because he felt he owed it to his family and to younger officers so they could move up. At any rate, he said, the job of operations director is a square hole, and I am a round peg. In the intelligence community, analysts and their bosses began to shut up in the fall of 2002. No one had to tell them to do so. The feeling was, our job is to do what we're told, and this thing is going to happen, said the senior military intelligence official. The feeling was, it wasn't our place to raise a ruckus. Indeed, by this point, the war already was beginning in quiet ways. Officers in the Gulf were told to be ready for war in spring. Army Lieutenant General David McKiernan, the commander of the Ground Invasion Force, said in an official Army debriefing interview in the summer of 2003 that I think from last fall we knew it was a question of just when, not if. Likewise, in September, a senior U.S. intelligence official in Bahrain told colleagues, "You'll see all this diplomatic stuff, but it's clear we're going to war."